I'm here today with John Prendergast, co-founder of the Enough Project, longtime human rights activist and author of The Enough Moment. Thank you for joining the Globe Observatory today.
Thanks for having me.
Mr. Prendergast, you just participated in a discussion here at IPI with outgoing International Criminal Court prosecutor Luis Moreno Ocampo on the challenges of enforcing arrest warrants. In your opinion, what will it take for the ICC and states to cooperate more effectively in securing the arrest of indicted war criminals?
Well, right now, as you know, there's no international police force to automatically execute the arrest warrants of the ICC, so there's no automaticity built into the international system to actually act upon anything that the ICC does. So that requires then for a more concerted effort by state parties and supporters of the International Criminal Court to craft individual arrest or apprehension strategies around every arrest warrant that is issued. It's befuddling and to me that 10 years into the existence of this court, we don't have that. I mean, it's remarkable, in fact, and sort of speaks volumes about the dysfunctionality of international institutions that are established on the basis of grand principles and then, you know, just fall completely short in practice. So what we have is a highly functioning, highly motivated legal process based in The Hague, and then states that have competing or no interest in creating some kind of a structure to actually implement the legal decisions that are made in which they by an organization that was created by these very same states that aren't doing anything to enforce them. So I feel that's the urgent next step in the international architecture is to build that step of creating and crafting strategies around individual apprehensions.
In maybe a slightly more hopeful vein, your organization, The Enough Project, has stated in a recent report that there currently is a golden opportunity to apprehend Congolese warlord Bosco Ntaganda. What would the significance be of taking Ntaganda out of the equation for the Eastern DRC, and what role should the ICC play in this process?
Well, I want to start the answer by remembering the millions of people who have died in Eastern Congo in this last dozen years of conflict. And as a result of warlords like Bosco, who run around making millions of dollars off the minerals that are stripped out of that country and are operating, have operated in total impunity. That's why this is such a tremendously important case. Is if in fact you can start with one person, you know, arrest one of them, one of the worst violators of human rights in Eastern Congo, one of the worst pillagers of Congolese resources, then you're making a dent, you're making a first step towards reversing the centuries-long slide that Eastern Congolese people have been embroiled in, not as a result of their own actions, but as a result of outsiders. So that I feel like the taking a stand on accountability for one actor can have a catalytic effect for many other things. And you see the demand for his arrest has already catalyzed change in Eastern Congo. You know, this whole parallel administration that Bosco and his cronies had developed in Eastern Congo in order to smuggle all the minerals out of there to Rwanda and Uganda is now at risk. It's crumbled, and now they've had to reorganize. They're on the run militarily. The big question now is, what is Rwanda going to do? Will Rwanda protect Bosco because of the interest that Bosco protected for Rwanda for many years? What's the quid pro quo there? Will the agreements that were brokered earlier between Congo and Rwanda hold, or will we go back to a state of open warfare in Eastern Congo? I mean, literally millions of lives hang in the balance on these questions, all started because somebody said, wait a minute, this guy shouldn't be allowed, the Terminator, as he's called, Bosco Ntaganda, should be allowed to just run around killing and raping and pillaging without any kind of accountability. So that's what you get. When you start hitting the hornet's nest, some things are going to change, and the international community needs to be ready to help the Congolese government and the Congolese people deal with the changes that are occurring right now today in Eastern Congo as we speak.
Speaking of cases that could serve as a catalyst and people speaking up about the need to do something about them, Invisible Children, which focuses on the plight of LRA-affected communities in Uganda and Central Africa, is one of your partners, at least according to your website. As an organization that makes extensive use of the internet and new media itself, what can you learn from the Kony 2012 campaign? And maybe in a more reflective vein, despite its unprecedented reach, do you believe this campaign will have a lasting effect? Did the message get through?
So I think that the most important outcome of this quite extraordinary phenomenon that occurred in response to the video release a couple of months ago is that it uncovers sort of a silent majority, a clear subset of publics in the United States and other countries that are interested enough to watch a 29-minute video that is not by a famous musician or is not a movie star, and it is a 29-minute video that talks about a place halfway around the world for most people, a place they'll never go, people they've never met, and it spurred tens of millions of those people to sign petitions and then hundreds of thousands of them to take fairly significant follow-up actions in support of the crafting a strategy to bring an end to this, the horrific crimes that Joseph Kony and the LRA have committed. That's what most politicians take away from it. That's the essential point that needs to be understood, is that this has had a political impact. That now you have the United States Senate and the United States House of Representatives and the President and the Obama administration all united much more clearly and openly to enhance their efforts to support the African nations, which are undertaking the effort to try to apprehend Kony. So my view is very strongly positive about the campaign so far. The key now is, will the campaign be able to follow up with, and you don't need 100 million people to change something. You need a small percentage of that are stay committed, and political actors who have to face election know this. So whatever the sort of intelligentsia or the academics want to say about it, it doesn't really matter, because it's actually impacting in real time the political process and increasing the political will to do something. So the key is, what are they going to do? And there aren't enough troops out there searching for Kony. They don't have the right transport. There aren't enough troops out there that are defending populations from reprisal attacks. The intelligence networks aren't built up strongly enough, and they don't have access to the areas where Kony and some of the top lieutenants are hiding. So there are significant gaps right now in the program. So if the next stage of the campaign can effectively address those missing ingredients of a successful strategy, if they can successfully address those, then we might have a successful apprehension, and which will, in my view, bring an end to the LRA and its atrocities. That would be an incredible testimony, not only to the work that the African states that have been on the ground working to try to bring an end to this for many years, but also a testimony to the idea that people around the world can organize and on the basis of a principle, on the basis of a cause, and actually help make an impact somewhere around the world.
Talking about advocacy strategies, and you've already mentioned the draw that stars and celebrities can have, and I'd be curious, because a lot of the Enough Project advocacy to inform policymaking and the general public about ways to prevent or stop the commission of crimes against humanity and genocide, in fact, involves working with celebrities. What specifically do these people bring to the table in supporting your campaigns? And would you say, is all media good media, or do you sometimes question whether bringing on board celebrities could ever trivialize a cause in any way?
Well, just like governments are different, NGOs are different, celebrities are different, and I think if you have a serious person who cares deeply about these issues and takes the time to go to the countries and learn about it and deepen their knowledge, that they can have a tremendous, they can make a tremendous contribution, particularly in recruiting people to the cause. I mean, that's really what these celebrities are. They're master recruiters for the cause, whether it's human trafficking or child slavery or child soldierdom or genocide or whatever the cause is, the environmental degradation, whatever the cause is, you know, when celebrities, when deployed effectively and when they take the time to learn about the issues, they can get tens of hundreds of thousands of new eyes on the issue that otherwise wouldn't be there. And many of those people stay engaged. So there really is no other, in this point in our in human history, there's no other catalyst that I see, that most people that deal with causes see, that can bring about the spikes in citizen interest as a celebrity who's deeply committed, who is willing to go there, and you know, the kind of people we've worked with, like George Clooney and Don Cheadle and Ryan Gosling and Angelina Jolie, Ashley Judd, people that have spent a lot of time in the field in Africa, who Ben Affleck committed to learning about why these things happen and then come back and try to educate people. I mean, I just simply don't see what could possibly be wrong with that. You know, they're just because they have a career that makes them live in a fishbowl, it's actually the fishbowl that they want to use to reflect the light away from them onto the causes that they care about. And I think that's an admirable thing. And I don't know why, again, there's so much criticism of it, because certainly it has an impact, a tremendous impact on political process and political will to do something about these deep, important issues.
Finally, do you feel that through the work of organizations like yours that are so able to harness international attention on these issues, also the creation and the success of the ICC and global awareness through the use of social media, do we now have a better chance to prevent the recurrence of genocide and the commission of crimes against humanity in Africa and beyond?
I believe we do. I believe that that this confluence of factors, particularly undergirded by an increased political will to prevent genocide, to address some of these worst human rights crimes that are continuing to be committed around the world. I think that the fact that more eyes can be brought, more attention can be brought to a particular issue overnight, you know, in the case of the Syrian people in the street, in the case of the Egyptians in the street, you know, having 10, 15 years ago, if there had been demonstrations like that, they would have been brutally crushed and we would never have heard from those people again. They would have been killed. But now with the Twittering and all of the kind of social media phenomenon and quickly catalyzing international media interest, which then quickly catalyzes governmental interest, it made it impossible for these governments to do what they normally would have done, which is, you know, massive human rights crimes. Certainly the loss of life in Syria is unacceptable, but I fear, shudder to think about what it would have been like had there not been the kind of international attention garnered on behalf of this. Same thing in Darfur. Had there not been an international effort around the genocide in Darfur, even though it didn't stop, you know, the conflict there, it certainly led the government of Sudan to be unable to use its favorite war tactic, which is starvation. They were harshly condemned and pressed very hard from countries all over the world to provide to allow the international agencies to go into Darfur and provide assistance. They didn't 10 years earlier in South Sudan, and you saw 2.25 million people die in that war. Well, 2.25 million people didn't die in Darfur because they allowed the assistance to go in because of the international act. My point is that the attention that all of these efforts has brought to bear, and the political will, which is continues to slowly and steadily increase to try to respond to atrocities and even in some cases prevent them. You know, the case of Libya being the shining star of, you know, attention suddenly being galvanized on a particular place around the world, the political will catalyzing in order to act in defense of people in eastern Libya who are at risk of being of a genocide in that area. And so, you know, yes, things happened after that, regime change, all the rest of it, which makes people critical of the whole responsibility to protect concept. But that concept and the effort to try to protect civilians and prevent some of these terrible human rights crimes, I think, is a lot stronger today than it's ever been in human history. And as long as international NGOs and the ICC and the organizations and entities that care about these kinds of issues continue to work on behalf of the survivors of these human rights crimes. And as long as governments are susceptible to political pressures to do something, I think we're going to continue to march forward in the international effort to try to bring an end to the worst of the human rights abuses and human rights crimes in the world today.
Mr. Prendergast, thanks so much for this interview.
Thank you for having me.